This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight is the first of a two-part interview with Laird Scranton about his latest book, which is absolutely awesome. And being under 200 pages, it is packed full of information. I mean, it is dense. It's not a quick read, despite being fairly short, because there's so much in there you just got to kind of sit with as you're reading it. And I highly, highly recommend it. It's kind of a background to all of his other work, and self-published, as he'll talk about. And again, highly recommended if you're interested in what he's talking about and you've read his other books. If you're a Patreon, you'll get both parts right away. You should have already gotten them, so you don't have to wait for the second part. For everyone else, the second part will be next week. And with that, let's get into this conversation. All right, Laird, welcome back to the show. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, well, thanks, Soraya. Thanks for having me back.
And I am very happy that you put this book out, even though you had to self-publish it, Seeking the Primordial.
That's right. The Inner Traditions has published my other books, and there's one in the shoot with them that won't be out until about May, but it sort of stood in the way. It's about the Maori of New Zealand, and I'm actually looking forward to it coming out, but stood in the way of publishing this material. And this material I really wanted to fast track, so I made a couple of runs at trying to convince them to do that. And the choice was, you know, do I wait until late 2019 or maybe early 2020 to see it in print, or do I self-publish it?
Yeah, well, I think you made the right choice, because I feel like this is the book I've been waiting for from you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, a lot of times it's like passing a message in a bottle into the sea, you know?
And it was funny, too, because I saw something about you having a new book out, and I went, I didn't know he had a new book out. And, you know, and I jumped over to the Inner Traditions page, and I saw the one on the Maori there, and I'm like, that's not so much. What's happening right now?
Yes. Well, as I said, I had made a couple approaches. I had even offered to go over to Inner Traditions to do a presentation for them. I had worked up a PowerPoint to try to talk to them about the material, try to convince them that this is something that we ought to not wait on.
Yeah.
But didn't succeed at that. So.
Well, at least you have the self-publishing route.
Yes, and actually it's a fairly simple route. I mean, I've always appreciated the good job that Inner Traditions does. You know, they have talented people, and I know authors may sometimes have some difficulties getting into the mode of a team effort rather than a personal effort, but it's a good team.
Hmm. Yeah, and they put out such good stuff, too. Okay, so this book kind of takes all the stuff you've worked on and wraps it into one cohesive whole with a little bit of speculation here and there about, the nature of reality.
Yeah, it's true. It really, really gets down to some pretty interesting possibilities. What I like about it most is that it ties up a number of the loose ends I had with the Dogon material, that the Dogon are talking about things that that didn't directly have correlate, didn't seem to directly have correlates on the scientific side, and I was anxious to try to sort those out and see how do these really link.
Yeah. So let's go through my list of questions after reading this. I'm not even sure totally where to start. This is so dense in the material, it's ridiculous.
Honestly, the reason I worked up the PowerPoint is because I needed it to keep myself on track and trying to explain this stuff in the right order for somebody.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem. I don't think my notes are quite in the right order, because some of it came as, you know, like I'd read something and then go a little further and make a note and then be like, wait, I also should note that. And but let's, you know, one of the things that's always interested me that you mentioned is the idea of the navel and its symbolism, because I remember Graham Hancock mentioning that so many ancient cultures have this symbolism of the navel. And I think Andrew Collins had mentioned it at some point as well. You know, everything is focused on that navel, and none of them seem to really know why, but you have some explanation as to what's going on here.
Well, I mean, the Dogon are doing a very complicated thing, or whoever put their system of symbols together was doing a very complicated thing. They could see that there are three themes of creation that are parallel to each other, fundamentally the same as each other. One is involves how the universe forms. Another one involves how matter forms. And the last one is the processes of biological reproduction. And so whoever put the system together chose to simultaneously describe all three themes using one progression of symbols. And that means that it's no longer fair to ask, what does this symbol represent? We really have to ask, what does the symbol represent in relation to one of those themes? But the navel is one of those symbols. And clearly, because it's expressed as a navel, the symbol pertains most immediately to biological reproduction. But the correlate on the macrocosmic and microcosmic side is the center of the axis of the tree of life, or the tree of matter. Actually, there are a couple of different trees that were defined in the ancient traditions, but that primordial axis by which everything is aligned, the center of that is the counterpart to the navel. Göbekli Tepe, one of the traditional translations of the name Göbekli Tepe, is hill with a navel, and that's really the one of the definitions of a Buddhist stupa. Also, is the notion of a hill with a navel.
Yeah, and it is literally found everywhere.
Yes.
So, you know, let's take a step back real quick. I know one of my co-hosts on the roundtables, Ren, had some doubts about the Dogon material, saying that, you know, I mean, he hadn't looked into it very closely, and that you know, and felt like it really wasn't worth looking at. Because he was afraid it had been hoaxed, which of course is one of the things that is out there, that the initial, you know, work was just hoaxed after they couldn't get anywhere with it. So do you want to explain that just a little bit?
Sure. There were the Dogon came to the public attention in 1975 when Robert Temple published a book called The Serious Mystery. The upshot of that was that the Dogon know things about astronomy, in particular. They know details about the Sirius star system that they shouldn't know without access to powerful telescopes. The Dogon are a modern, primitive African tribe. So Carl Sagan was the first person to make a run at that, and his response was, well, clearly some modern visitor who had knowledge of the Sirius stars came to visit, and the Dogon just incorporated that material into their lore. Well, there are immediate objections to that. If Sagan had looked a little bit deeper, he'd realize that the Dogon material is given in ancient Egyptian words that went out of use around 750 BC. So the chances of a modern visitor having conveyed that information to the Dogon using those words is almost nil. But if you carry that a little bit farther, you realize that even in ancient Egypt, you can see similar information. The Dogon are saying that there are there's not just one bright Sirius star. There's a second dwarf star, a dark small star that is in a binary pairing with the brighter star. Now, if you go to ancient Egypt, we know that the goddess Isis represented Sirius, the bright star of Sirius. But before we even say that, we are sort of tacitly agreeing to play a game that I call "You say goddess, I say star." And so when the Egyptian myths go on to tell us that Isis has a dark sister named Nephthys, they've just conveyed the same essential information that Dogon had, that there's a second star there. It's a dark star. And so that is additional confirmation in combination with the Egyptian words that show that this material came out of ancient sources, not out of modern ones. Now, the second run at the legitimacy of the Dogon cosmology came from a Belgian anthropologist by the name of Walter Van Beek. Professor Van Beek is a well-known figure on the anthropological scene. He edits an anthropological journal through the University of Chicago. He took a team in to restudy the Dogon cosmology that the French anthropologist had studied for 30 years. It's not unusual in the field of anthropology to see a restudy done. Usually it's a restudy of a small piece of some other person's work. In this case, Van Beek was trying to validate 30 years worth of work with a 3 or 4 year study. Van Beek's expertise wasn't religion, ecology. And so he took a team in, working from the French anthropologist's statements that this was the Dogon symbology was a closely held secret tradition. Van Beek's team concluded that they had found no evidence of the Dogon esoteric tradition. I joke that sometimes I'll post a meme that says the Dogon say that that their religion is a closely held secret tradition. Van Beek found no evidence of it. Looks like the Dogon were right. But the critical piece that Van Beek missed was he didn't notice that the Dogon granary, which is an aligned shrine, is a very close match in a number of different ways for a Buddhist stupa. And the Dogon cosmology was also, that goes along with that shrine, is also a very close match for the cosmology that goes with the Buddhist stupa. Van Beek had claimed that the Dogon cosmology was a fabricated tradition, that the Dogon priests had just made up answers to the questions that the French anthropologist was asking, essentially fabricated the cosmology for him. But because the shrines align and because the cosmologies that go with the shrines align, that would be like saying that the Dogon priests casually embedded Buddhism. It's not a credible claim. So from my point of view, there's no evidence whatsoever of a hoax in the Dogon tradition. And in fact, the serious star information that is reflected in it is just the very smallest tip of an iceberg. A much larger iceberg of scientific knowledge is reflected in the Dogon cosmology. And this is science that you can lay out side by side with modern scientific statements and draw and diagrams and demonstrate that it's really correct knowledge.
Now, I had heard somewhere, and I don't remember where, that the Dogons actually hinted there may have been a third star of the Sirius system that we haven't found yet.
Yeah, the Dogon do say that there's a third body there, and there have been hints that there is something else in the system. I'm not sure what the current state of the astronomical knowledge is. For a while, there was a debate whether there might be a third star or a third planet orbiting the binary stars. I think they found validation for the fact that there's another body there. I don't know off the top of my head whether they've determined whether it's another star or whether it's a planet.
Do you get any hint from the Dogon on what they're saying it is?
No, I haven't really deeply explored that piece of it because it doesn't have bearing on the cosmology. But I'm sure there's information there. If I wanted to go back through the anthropological study and dig it out, I could cross-compare to some of the other traditions I work with and possibly learn something about that third body.
Okay. Because that's really fascinating. I mean, if they know there's a third body there and we find out that there's a third body there, that just solidifies that information all the more.
Right, and the Dogon know the correct orbital period for the two major stars. They know that it's a 50-year cycle, which is, again, something they shouldn't know. The problem is that the bright star is so bright that the dark star sits in the glare of the bright star and it can't be directly observed without really specialized equipment. Until, I think, 1918 or so, astronomers didn't even know the second star was there.
And Temple posits that the Dogon say that extraterrestrials came down and gave them this knowledge from Sirius, but that's not actually what it says, is it?
Well, that was his take on things. Now, yeah. To be fair to Temple, he was working before there was a complete English translation of the anthropological study.
Okay.
He had a couple of translated chapters, but from my perspective, a lot of his outlook is slightly off the mark of what the actual truth is. But that's really no different than the anthropologists themselves. The way the esoteric tradition works, the innermost secrets of the tradition aren't learned by an initiate until well into their process. So if you read an article written by the anthropologists before 1950, you find that a lot of what they're reporting in the article ends up being off the mark of what their final study said.
Okay. All right. And I guess it's probably important that you tell people just a little bit of background on the whole idea of the stupa and why it matters.
The stupa is, like the Dogon Granary Shrine, is considered to be the grand symbol of the cosmological tradition. This is an entry point. One of the first exercises given to a Buddhist initiate is to teach them a method of geometry that's used to align a shrine. And I think the Buddhists most typically practice that method using sand on a flat terrace. Rather than actually marking it out in a field the way the Dogon tribes people would. But this geometry is the root of what we call sacred geometry. The initial purpose of it is to demonstrate how to align these shrines. The act of aligning it has important symbolism to the cosmology in the long run. But during the process of laying out this geometry, the first step is to essentially draw a circle around a central point. A Dogon initiate needs is an empty field and a stick. And they set the stick vertically in the ground and then draw a circle around that stick at the same diameter same radius as the stick. And then they mark the two longest shadows of the day, morning and evening, at the points where the shadow of the stick intersects the circle. And those two points become the center points for two new circles of a slightly larger radius. They get drawn around those and create an intersecting point that looks a lot like the Vesica Pisces. This geometry, the first stage of it creates an effective sundial. It's a way of tracking time during the hours of the day based on the shadow cast by the stick. But the marking of this, the endpoints, they produce a line that is oriented east to west because the shadow of the sun that rises in the morning and the shadow of the sun that sets at night, sun rises in the east and sets in the west, those two points end up automatically being aligned in an east-west orientation. And when you create two circles on those as central points, you generate two more intersecting points that define a north-south aligned line. So you've produced an alignment. Now, if you were to mark that east-west line every day for a year, you would watch it slowly move northward until you hit the solstice, back through the shadow would pass back through the stick at the equinox, and then it would move southward to the next solstice. So what you've done with the line is given visibility to the seasons of the year. This is a function that's necessary for a successful agriculture, so that the farmers know when to plant and when to harvest. So that geometry ends up being the basis of a shrine. Now, both the Dogon and the Buddhist shrines evoke a particular series of shapes in the same sequence, and those shapes carry the same symbolism. For example, the base of the shrine represents the earth, and the roof of the shrine represents the sky. For the Dogon shrine, there's a circle in the flat roof that represents the moon. And you have symbolism. The base plan, the circle with a dot in the middle of it, is a symbol for the sun. And so you have symbolism that plays out on a local solar system level. You have symbolism that plays out in terms of timekeeping functions. You have effects of the geometry that help with agriculture. The finished Dogon shrine has four flat faces. It produces a round base that rises to a square top. So it's roughly pyramidal. And that produces four flat faces. Each face is associated with a constellation whose risings and settings regulate the agricultural cycle. The same is true of pyramids around the world. There are pyramids that carry the exact same symbolism, where the four flat faces of the pyramid represent or symbolize constellations that regulate the agricultural cycle. You've also, in the Dogon Granary, got an opening two-thirds of the way up the north side, the same way the Great Pyramid has its entrance, its official entrance, up two-thirds of the way up the north side. So there's a lot of connectivity to this shrine concept that moves from culture to culture all around the world.
And it shows that these two things can't have come together. Like, the Buddha stupa and the granary aren't accidentally similar. They're the same thing on different cultures.
Right. And the thing that demonstrates that is the complicated symbolism that attends the form. This is the argument against parallel development in ancient cultures of things like pyramids. You know, if you have a culture that builds primarily out of stone, it's only going to be a short amount of time before they think to stack those stones up and make a pyramid. How many things can you do with blocks of stone? But there's complicated symbolism that attends that pyramid function wherever we find it around the world. And it's that symbolism that that tips us off that this wasn't parallel development. It's common. These are derived from a common system of thought.
Right. And now this has deeper symbolism to it as well, though.
The shape does have deeper symbolism to it. Now we can see outwardly that the geometry is giving visibility to timekeeping in a material world. The sundial tracks the moments of a day, the hours of a day, the way we track them in the material world. But there's deeper symbolism to the oscillation of the line back and forth that represents the seasons. When you get down into more of an understanding of what's going on, you understand that the geometry is reconciling concepts of time as it's experienced in a material realm with concepts of time as it's thought to be experienced in a non-material realm. Now, to get to that is a little tricky. We need to start with the underlying philosophy of this whole system is a cosmological philosophy called Samkhya. Samkhya is understood to have preceded the Vedic and the Buddhist and the Hindu traditions in India. It's a companion philosophy to yoga, which has all of the same symbolic concepts, only reflected in relation to an individual rather than a universe. Now, in the mindset of Samkhya, universes form in pairs, that our material universe is paired with a non-material universe that we can't see, we can't directly perceive. In Buddhism, we have a concept of a yuga cycle that says that over very long periods of time, humanity's ability to perceive this non-material realm changes, and that in ancient times there was a heightened sense of perception of the non-material as opposed to what we see now. Anybody who's ever become familiar with ancient Egyptian art and symbolism and mythology and so forth understands that it looks as if they were more intimately connected with the non-material or spiritual things than modern society is. So Samkhya provides us with a framework to explain how that happens. In the mindset of Samkhya, which is also the mindset of the Dogon cosmology, there is a cycle of energy that scrolls from one universe to the other. And this cycle of energy, the Dogon compare it to, they say that it's as essential to life as the natural water cycle is to life on Earth. The natural water cycle is the process by which water evaporates from bodies of water and forms clouds. Those clouds rise up over the mountains and drop their rain, which then flows back to the bodies of water. Without that cycle, that flow of that movement of water, there would be no life on Earth. That's partly why the Dogon say that life is, they see life as being more involving more of a movement of forces than a single force. Well, the same thing is happening, according to the Dogen and according to Samkhya, on the level, on the scale of universes, that there's a cycle of energy that scrolls from the non-material side to the material side, and that energy is essential to life. The more we dig into it, though, the more we start to understand that it's not just energy that's scrolling from one side to the other. You know, think of an hourglass and sand shifting from the upper half of the glass to the lower half of the glass. It's not just energy that's scrolling, it's also mass. Albert Einstein, in his theory of relativity, says that there are side effects of changing the massiveness of something. That if you make a thing more massive, it's the equivalent of accelerating it. And when you do that, you slow its time frame. One of the examples was, if you had astronauts moving very close to the speed of light, moving away from the Earth, and they were able to look back with a very powerful telescope, they'd notice that a person like you or I might pass our entire day in the same amount of time it takes them to lift a cup and take a sip of coffee. Right. Their time frame slows as they accelerate. Time frame slows as you increase mass. And what that means is that any virtually massless realm must persist within an ultra-quick time frame compared to ours, that the less massive a thing becomes, the quicker its time frame is. This would also be true of matter in its wave-like state, where it has no mass, that those waves must, because they have no mass or virtually no mass, have to exist within a very ultra-quick time frame compared to ours. Now, Heisenberg says, if we observe something that is below a certain level of massiveness, that we automatically disturb it when we observe it. The very act of observing it disturbs it.
Right.
So if we're dealing with a virtually massless wave that has virtually no acceleration and is persisting in a very, very quick time frame, our act of perceiving it can only do one thing. It accelerates it. And when it accelerates it, it imparts a little bit of mass to it. And as it imparts that mass, it slows its time frame. Now, that act of perception, according to the Dogen, sets off a kind of a chain reaction. And the reaction is, you might compare it to blowing bubbles from a bubble wand. That if you've ever tried that, you stick the wand in the little bottle of bubble fluid, and you blow a bubble, and the first few that you try to blow have such little tensile strength that the bubbles don't hold their form. They pop. That's what happens with matter also, that the first six of these bubbles end up popping before they're able to hold any kind of a shape. The seventh one finally has enough mass to be able to hold its shape for a while. And so that ends up producing what astrophysicists call the Calabi-Yau space, a bundle of collapsed dimensions that are said to exist at every point in space and time. Now that process is fundamentally a process, from my point of view, is fundamentally a process of the slowing of time frame. Another way to think of it is it's comparable sort of in a reversed way to the way, water pressure works. The deeper you get into water, the greater the water pressure is. Mm-hmm. And difference in water pressure can cause things to happen. For example, if you take a hollow ball to the bottom of a swimming pool and let go of it, it'll bob up out automatically to the surface in very much the same way that gravity causes a ball to fall down to the surface.
Okay.
So there are correlations to be had here and processes we know about that can be compared to processes we're not sure about to try to infer what must be true about them. This is part of the power of the parallel themes of this cosmology, the way the Dogen describe it, is that if they can point to a process that happens in one of the realms, say in the macrocosm above us, if they can point to a structure that we can observe and see how it functions, then we're in a position to understand that the Dogen description of a correlate to that structure that happens in the microcosm that's too small for us to see, where they describe it as functioning in the same way, we have a way of linking, making linkage between microcosmic processes and macrocosmic ones.
Now, one of the things you're talking about in here is the old concept of the ether, or the aether.
Right.
And this is something that's not accepted by science. It was an idea that was thrown around. I think you said Einstein supported it at one point, but it's kind of been thrown out in favor of other things that, like dark matter, that aren't really proven at all. So how does this fit into you, to the whole Dogon philosophy and this ancient philosophy that you're putting together here?
Well, Einstein never rejected the concept of an ether. As a matter of fact, he flatly said that there could theoretically be an ether. In fact, his concept of the gravitational lensing of light requires the concept of an ether. The difficulty is that the formulations that Einstein put forward, the E equal mc squared formulation and some of the things that were derived from that, ended up creating a mindset for astrophysics that sort of disincluded it. Not that it ever rejected it, it just sort of framed their point of view around it, sort of avoided the whole discussion of it. Einstein said that if there were an ether, that it would have to have some rigidity unto itself, but it would also have to be flexible, it would have to be able to bend. And that's the concept that the Dogen are working from. Now, in order to let's back up here. The Dogen priests say that their symbolic system describes, among other things, how matter forms. And when I made my entry point into this, I could see I knew enough about the processes to know that they'd correctly described an atom, and they correctly described and diagrammed electrons, protons, and neutrons. They knew what the relationship of electrons, protons, and neutrons were to an atom. And I could set their descriptions and their drawings side by side with descriptions and diagrams from Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene, and we had a match. So I set out to try to educate myself enough to know, could the rest of the descending structure that Dogen described also be correct? And I discovered it is. It's intuitively correct. You can set it, all of it. I mean, in stages, you can set it side by side with these scientific popularizers of astrophysics and satisfy yourself that there's an intuitive agreement between what the Dogen say is happening and what the scientists have learned is happening. So this is correct science from the level of waves all the way up to the level of the atom. The Dogen seem to know what they're talking about. A physicist friend of mine who ought to know says that the version of string theory that most closely is matched by the Dogen system is a controversial version called torsion theory. Torsion theory postulates that at every point in space and time, you have a tiny little whirlpool, a tiny little vortex. And in fact, this collection of collapsed dimensions, collapsed bubbles that the Dogen put at that same spot, is alternately conceptualized as a tiny spinning spiral. So as I did my comparisons back and forth between what the Dogen were saying and what the astrophysicists were saying, we had a match from waves all the way up to the atom. Now that's as far as my overview of the processes went. And so from my point of view, we had a pretty coherent, complete match. The difficulty was that as you get deeper into the anthropological study of the Dogen, there are some additional stages of more foundational stages that the Dogen describe that Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene don't talk about. There are descriptions and diagrams, drawings of what these stages are and how they work and how they precede the concept of matter as waves. So the fundamental concept of this new book, Seeking the Primordial, is to try to make sense of that initiating structure the Dogon have that I hadn't previously tied to science. The ways that I go about doing that are, first, my starting point was the geometry of the stupa shrine, that sacred geometry. I had the inclination to ask a question that I realized that no researcher I had was aware of had ever thought to ask over the 20 years I had been studying things. The question was, could that sacred geometry that's used to align the stupa shrine be the geometry of something? Well, it turns out it is. The initial circle with the dot in the middle of it, the stick in the field that we draw the circle around, is a diagram of what's called angular momentum. This is one of the fundamental building blocks of matter. This is what you get when you spin electromagnetism. And the process of spinning electromagnetism is what produces mass, relativistic mass as we see it. There are two concepts of mass that are being discussed in classes on astrophysics these days. One is Einstein's classical concept of relativistic mass, where the more you accelerate a thing, the more massive it becomes. There's also a second concept called static mass or constant mass, inherent mass. The idea is that there's no additional substance actually being acquired by the thing as it becomes more massive, just as there's no additional substance being acquired by water as it becomes more, as the pressure gets greater. But the more water you have in one place, and the deeper that water goes, the greater the pressure gets. Now, one of my difficulties with this concept of invariant mass or inherent mass is that it tends to train students to think past the relativistic mass, which is where all the value is according to the Samkhya and the Dogon system, because all of the things that we attribute to weird quantum effects really, from my point of view, accrue from changes in mass and time frame because of relativistic mass. That essentially what we're doing when we perceive a wave is we're imparting mass to it and we're slowing its time frame enough to essentially move it into the range of our perception. And as we do that, we're creating some structures that that the effect of perceiving a virtually massless wave is very similar to the effect of suddenly stepping on the brake of your car as you're traveling down the highway at 70 miles an hour. When you do that, the car starts to vibrate. So does the wave. The wave starts to vibrate and to pivot. And as it pivots, it encircles. And as it encircles, it creates an enclosed space. So one of the ways that space is, one of the dynamics by which space is being created from a massless wave is this vibration and pivoting. There's another effect going on. If you think of matter in its massless state as persisting in an ultra-quick time frame, it reaches a point where if you had no mass, you would have infinitely quick time frame. Everything would essentially happen at once. Right. Now, in that kind of a context, if it takes me no time to walk from my house across town to the other side of town, then effectively there's no distance between my house and the other side of town. Without a time frame to measure it in, the concept of space and distance doesn't exist. So simply by quickening time frame, which is what we do by reducing mass, we also evaporate the concept of space. So when you get down to a level where you're virtually massless and have virtually infinitely quick time frame, you've essentially entangled everything. You've created quantum entanglement between everything, all the particles, because space, the concept of space and distance has no meaning anymore. So it's as if everything is one thing.
Yeah.
And that's why the non-material is considered to be unity, whereas the material is considered to be multiplicity, because as soon as you impart a little bit of mass, you're slowing time frame, and when you slow time frame, you automatically create the concept of space.
Huh. One of the things that stuck out to me about that, too, was that it's not completely different from the electric universe idea, that there is like a, that you have these underlying Birkeln currents underneath reality that are, that also need a sort of ether to manifest.
Yes. And actually electromagnetism is at the heart of this. Now, what I hadn't realized before I wrote this book is that the electricity and magnetism that combine to form electromagnetism, the wavelengths of these energies link with each other essentially at right angles to each other. That you're creating, okay, first of all, electromagnetism begins with a kind of vibration that characterizes a dipole, and it produces the kind of an axis we were talking about when we talked about navels.
Okay.
Because those energies link at essentially right angles to each other, they're presaging an axis.
Okay.
Electricity and magnetism. Okay, in the Samkhya mindset, the processes of material creation are catalyzed when two energies of different quality come together. One is considered to be the energy of the non-material, which I take to be magnetism, and the other is an energy has the quality of the material, which I take to be electricity. And when those come together, anytime you have two energetic streams come together, whether it be water, whether it be energy, whatever, energetic streams of different qualities, you produce a spin. You're producing a vortex, a tiny little whirlpool, automatically producing it. And when you produce that spin, the initial effect of that creates what scientists call virtual particle pairing. Virtual particles, under the right circumstances, can result in the production of a photon, which is light, and an electron, which is basically electricity. One is a mass particle and the other one is not. When virtual particles come together, they create a shape because of the way they move around each other. They create a shape that is identical to what you get if you map out the orbit of the two Sirius stars over time. It's shape that looks like the Vesica Pisces that crosses over each again and again over each other, over and under each other. It's the equivalent in two dimensions of the helix of DNA. Huh. That shape, if you put your thumb and your forefinger together and extend them as far as they will go, that's the shape you're producing. It's the shape of the Vesica Pisces. And that's what we're referring to as an ether unit. The comparison is to an outsider's reformulation of astrophysics. There's was a graduate student in astrophysics by the name of David W. Thompson III, who kept asking foundational questions of his professors, and kept getting sort of what he considered to be bullshit answers from the professors about, like, where do dimensions come from, and what is the nature of time outside of a material frame. If it looks like these things begin outside of the material frame, does that mean that there's a second space outside of the material frame? Where do these things come from? And the professors wouldn't answer those questions. Those are from the view of modern astrophysics, all the units of measure are sort of defined on the largest measurable thing, David W. Thompson decided to reformulate those units based on the smallest measurable thing. And the system he produced looks remarkably like the Dogen cosmology, and it includes many of the same foundational structures that Dogen talk about, and those structures are understood the same way that Dogen understand them. Let's back up just a little bit. We were talking about angular momentum representing the first piece of the geometry of the stupa.
Right.
If we take the full alignment geometry of the stupa, what we get is a representation of what's called half-spin particles. As matter forms, there are more, Stephen Hawking says, more than 200 fundamental particles. The Dogen say there are 266 of them. These particles are classified both by the physicists and by the Dogen based on symmetry of the particles, basically how the particle looks from different angles. There's one class of particle that looks the same from all sides. There's another class of particle that's like an arrow. It has to be turned halfway around, or it has to be turned all the way around to look the same. There's another class of particle that's akin to a double-headed arrow that has to be turned halfway around to look the same. But there's a fourth category of particle that is very odd because it has to be turned around twice to look the same. Now, one of the ways of understanding that is to imagine that maybe the geometry of this particle in some way passes through into and out of a domain that we don't see, a blind spot. I compare the blind spot to the blind spot that's created by the mirrors in a car.
Mm.
If you were a driving student just learning how to drive and your instructor didn't point out to you that those mirrors create a blind spot, you might potentially drive your entire driving career and never notice that it was there, but there is a blind spot there large enough to hide a tractor trailer if it's positioned right.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that these half-spin particles work, these are the kinds of particles that point to the potential existence of a blind spot for science. And it's in that blind spot where important things seem to happen. Now, so sacred geometry is, okay, besides representing the geometry of that half-spin particle, that very same geometry is the geometry that's put forward when scientists try to explain how the concept of time works. That if they are diagramming the forward and past effects of time, they tend to produce a diagram that is two inward-facing cones that meet at the tip, where one represents the all of the past events, the other one represents the future events. So there's a suggestion, just as with the stupa geometry, that this geometry has an essential relationship to the very nature of how time works.
Hmm. You know, I can't help but think when you said, you have to turn it around three times to get it to work, I feel like that's a USB plug.
Yes, that's my experience too. For some reason, that never just goes right in, does it?
Yeah. Like, oh, must be the wrong way. Nope. Oh, now you're going to go in. All right.
That's right.
But it's a good way to look at a half-spin particle, I guess.
So now, from Thompson's point of view, time in its generic form is an oscillation. Now, this agrees with a Buddhist concept. One of the ways the Buddhists represent the concept of time is with the action of a clapper of a bell that swings back and forth. This is an oscillation. Another way that Thompson simplifies that for our understanding is to compare it to a turning bicycle wheel. But the effect of, for us in the material standpoint, I compare to a swimmer in a swimming pool who's doing the crawl stroke with a viewer who's sitting in the stands watching the swimmer sees the forward action of the arms of the crawl stroke, but can't see the backward pull of the arm as it goes under the water to return back to where it came from. There's a circular motion going on that we only see half of. Now, as it turns out, angular momentum, as it spins, has an effect. it produces what's called a moment. This is equivalent to, if we think of the oscillation as being the oscillation of a dipole, there's a concept called a dipole moment. And the dipole moment is a vector that emerges from the center of that sundial, basically, and moves in one direction outward from the center of the sundial. So from my point of view, the angular momentum that is created by these two energies coming together to create the vortex or the virtual particle, the ether unit, the Vesica Pisces, that spin is what is translating an oscillation of time on the non-material side to a vector of time on the material side. And it's because of its effect as a dipole and the production of that dipole moment that is coming out of the center of the dipole that we see only a single direction of time rather than the full oscillation.
Right. Huh. Let's, one of the things you talk about, let's change direction here a little bit. One of the things you talk about is that all these cultures say that there is a flaw in creation. Can you get into that a little? Because that's a really fascinating idea.
All of the ancient esoteric traditions that I've studied have this concept, the idea that they describe it in different ways, but one of the ways it's typically described as being a flaw in the formation of the material universe. But what they're really talking about is a structural difference between a material and a non-material universe. Because at the bottom of the Samkhya philosophy and the Dogen philosophy, there is no real value judgment being placed here. This is not an idea that the non-material universe precedes or in any way is inherently morally or spiritually better than the material universe. We have a cycle going on here, a cycle of scrolling energy, and energy essentially scrolls out like a Torah scroll until it reaches the extent of its ability to scroll, and then it reverses itself and flows back. And so what we're calling the material and the non-material universes are really taking turns being that what we really have is a material that is becoming less material, and a universe that's becoming more material. Until we finally reach the full extent, then we have a fully descended universe as the fully material universe, and a fully ascended universe, which is the non-material universe. But as soon as we reach that point, the cycle begins to reverse itself, and eventually that energy scrolls back, and the roles switch places. Now, what I was trying to get at here was the structural difference between the two universes. One of the ways that's represented is cosmologically is with sushi, the way sushi is prepared. Anybody who's paid attention realizes that there are two types of sushi, one where the seaweed wraps around the outside of the rice, and the other where the seaweed wraps around the inside of the rice. Well, from the way Dogen described things, that's the essential difference between the non-material and the material universes, the structures of them. Now, that concept is conveyed in a number of different ways, depending on the tradition you look at. In Dogen culture, they're comparing the processes, the stages of formation of the universe or of matter to a series of sequential stages they number. By one metaphor, the Dogen are relating it to seven or to eight ancestors who descend. And they say that as we get to the end of that process, the eighth ancestor ended up descending before the seventh ancestor. He descended out of sequence, and that created a great disturbance, and that's what caused the difference between the two universes. In Kabbalism, they frame it a different way. They frame it in terms of the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And what they say is that Adam and Eve made the mistaken choice to consummate their relationship sooner than they were supposed to. They were supposed to wait until a certain number of days after a particular holiday, and instead they consummated it too soon. And because they consummated it too soon, that created a flaw in the universes that would have to be worked out. Now, in Kabbalism, it's understood that events that happened at the time of creation happened much more quickly than they do after that. And so they say it was going to take 6,000 years of celebrating the high holy days in Judaism, approximately, before that flaw would automatically rectify itself. Well, we're sitting now, by the count of the Hebrew calendar, we're at 5778 is the current Hebrew year. That's very close to 6,000 years. So from the perspective of the Hebrew calendar, we're at the end of this scrolling cycle. It's just about to start to reverse itself. But in every case, these metaphors about there being a flaw in the nature of the material universe is really just a way, a metaphoric way of trying to convey the idea that there's a difference in structure. And at the bottom, the Dogen admit that no ancestor really came down before the other one. In the myth, as it's told, the seventh ancestor became so angry that the eighth one came down first that he killed the eighth ancestor. Hmm. Well, the Dogen priest, when pressed, says, well, in truth, nobody died, nobody killed anybody. This is just a way of expressing a cosmological concept.
But is it meant to be flawed? Like, what would be the ideal situation?
It's really only, as I said, only trying to express the concept of a difference. And so, yes, that the qualities of a non-material universe depend on that difference, of a material universe depend on its structure being different than that of a non-material one. So when you say, is it meant to be different? I can only answer that by saying that the circumstances that we're expecting of these two universes only happen because of the difference.
Huh. Okay. Okay.
But the Dogen don't frame that. They don't place a value judgment on it. They're not saying one is better than the other or that one precedes the other. In fact, they treat the two universes as siblings. In the Dogen myths, they're treated as a male and female sibling who are who become separated from each other, and the purpose, the goal of the material universe for all eternity is to try to seek but never actually be able to find its twin.
Huh. Okay. Let's take a quick break. Tell people where they can get the book.
Okay. The book is available. This is a self-published book. The other books of my series have been through Inner Traditions. This book is available through Amazon. It should shortly be available through bookstores. It can be ordered through any bookstore right as it stands now. It's called Seeking the Primordial. It should be as accessible as any of my other books.
Okay. And you don't have a web page, right?
I don't have a web page. The easiest place to find me is on Facebook. I'm the only Laird Scranton on Facebook.
All right. And a special thanks to our Patreons who are pledging at the $10 or above level. John Eddy, Chris Elmquist, Patricia Gaiaquinta, Roland Belstedt, Alfred Tuttle, Carla Mahoney, and Gabriel Zero. Thank you very much. All right. I hope you enjoyed that. The second part of this conversation will air next week. And as I said, if you're a Patreon, you already have the entire conversation. All right. To take you out, this is Psyche Corporation. A song I used to end with all the time. This is Worrying World. See you next time.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the ballet? age of the universe. Ventricles and Tetriarch, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear the ballet face? The whirring of the world. Can you hear the ballet face? The whirring of the world. Can you hear? Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.